Hello, I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us today as we look at Abraham Lincoln, a look at Lincoln's place in America today. Our guest to talk with us is Andrew Ferguson, a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. He's written for The New Yorker, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and many other national publications. He's the author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. Andrew, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You were born in Illinois, and so you have a close relationship with the former president.
That's kind of a grand way to put it, but I think it's true. Like a lot of Americans, I was raised to revere Lincoln, and my own associations with him are perhaps a little unique in one way. I grew up in a house on Lincoln Street. Illinois, of course, is the land of Lincoln. My father was a partner in a law firm founded by Abraham Lincoln's only surviving son back in the 1880s called Isham Lincoln and Beale. Mm-hmm. I remember going into his office when I was a little boy, and there would be this very large, imposing photograph of Robert Todd Lincoln with a big walrus mustache, you know. So I felt a kind of affinity for Lincoln, a special relationship, the way I think a lot of people did, especially back in those days, maybe less so now.
You are, if I'm correct, about 50 years old.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you're not any youngster coming at Lincoln from just out of college or something like that.
No.
When you share your impressions of the former president, how do you see him?
Well, you know, that's actually one of the reasons I wrote the book, because, as I say, I kind of grew up as a buff. I, you know, watch that great John Ford movie, Abraham Lincoln in Illinois, and I read a number of books about him, children's books when I was a kid. And mm-hmm. I even had pictures of him on my wall, and before I became obsessed with the Beatles and then Susan Day and some other adolescent things that replaced Abraham Lincoln. But that was a time in the early 60s when we were going through the centenary of the Civil War. And there was a great deal of interest in Lincoln and, of course, the Civil War at the time.
Yes.
And after that, there was a drop-off, not only of interest in Lincoln, but in American history in general. Of course, now we see every couple of years, it seems, there's a new survey out that shows, you know, high school kids don't know which half-century the Civil War was fought in and so on. That wasn't really true when I was a kid, but when I found that he was starting to fade a little bit from the public view, I realized that, you know, I didn't know that much about him either. I had all the myths in my head, of course, and I'd read all the books as a child, but I still didn't have a good, firm view of what was it that Lincoln did. What did he believe? What were the actions that he took that have caused him to be this object of reverence throughout the 140 years since he's been dead? And so that was sort of how I took off on the book. I got in my car and drove around, and I thought maybe if I could find Lincoln through the people who obsess about him, who love him, who hate him, there are such people, that maybe I could get at the man that way.
Our guest is Andrew Ferguson. He's a senior editor at the Weekly Standard and is the author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. And we would like to hear your thoughts about the former president and his place in America today. And as we go along, we'll take Andrew Ferguson's travelogue, and we will see where little outposts of Lincoln occur around the country. For many high school kids and really people who watch television, Abe Lincoln is nothing more than a character in a TV commercial for Insomnia, along with, if I'm right, it's a prairie dog and a deep sea diver.
That's right. You can tell which one is Abe, though, because he's got the hat.
Yeah, but you know, if they look at the characters, they really have no feeling for the president himself.
Right. Well, you know, this is actually something interesting. Trying to get hold of Lincoln is also trying to get hold of the country, because he's so enmeshed in how we see ourselves and how we see the country. This phenomenon of Lincoln on these TV commercials actually has a very long lineage. Lincoln, I'd say probably by the 1880s, was being used to sell soap, tobacco, patent medicines, a lot of of his quotes from his speeches were put on magical elixirs that, you know, people would sell out of the back of wagons and so on. So, you know, we are, as they say, the commercial republic. This is a country dedicated to commerce, and so it's not too surprising that we should take this revered personage and try and make him pay.
Before we go to Richmond, let's take some calls. We do have lines open for you if you have a question or comment about Abe Lincoln. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Let's start off with Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Good morning, Jim, and thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
Happy Memorial Day to you.
Thank you.
And hello, Mr. Ferguson. I just picked up your book the other day, so I'm looking forward to reading it.
Okay.
My question is this. You know, we all seem to know who Lincoln is, but would you say that many of our leaders in government today really still continue to study him and take what he really had to say in their decision-making on how to govern? Because as we all know, Lincoln was, faced without a doubt the greatest crisis, I think, still today in the history of this country. But it seems like our leaders in government are so far removed from the common people, at least that's the general idea. And it seems because of that, majority of the society seems to be turned off of politics.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, there's two sides to an icon, an upside and a downside. I guess you can call Lincoln an icon. One is his greatness is very large and inspiring. On the other hand, his greatness tends to diminish everyone else that we may have in contemporary America. Certainly, he's a political figure that other politicians want to wrap themselves around. Cover politics once in a while, and I was out with Rudy Giuliani writing a story about him. He mentions Abraham Lincoln literally in every stump speech and interview as sort of a way of, I don't know, kind of basking in the reflected glow. And of course, then Barack Obama very pointedly decided to declare his candidacy at the old state capitol building in Springfield, Illinois, which is, of course, Lincoln's hometown, and the site where Lincoln gave some of his greatest speeches, closely associated with him. So it's again, there's not anything new in this either, but if they're not, I don't know, if they're not embodying Lincoln's values, they're certainly trying to lay claim to him.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, thanks, gentlemen.
All right, Boyd, thank you very much for getting us started this morning. Appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join in, we do have lines open for your call as well. You begin this book by, as you say, getting in the car and heading off to Richmond, Virginia. And that's that's something that's very deliberate as opposed to just being an accidental stop.
Right. I guess it was probably winter of 2003 or 2004. I picked up my paper from the stoop one morning, and there was a headline that said, "A Lincoln statue stirs outrage in Richmond." And, you know, the whole idea of outrage and Lincoln in the same sentence just didn't make sense to me. But sure enough, I read the story, and there was a group of sort of city fathers in Richmond who had gotten together, pooled their resources, and bought a statue of Abraham Lincoln that they wanted to install in a National Park Service site there on the banks of the James River in Richmond, Virginia. Of course, Richmond is the capital of the Confederacy, and in many ways, I guess, still is as a spiritual matter. But I was still intrigued that there could be a large segment of a very modern and sophisticated city that was upset about a statue of Abraham Lincoln. So I went down there and poked around and met a lot of the people who had objected to the statue, who actually really kind of, I'd say they ran counter to what I expected. They were much more sophisticated than I would have thought. I think the usual idea of these guys is sort of neo-Confederates, you know, they're chewing on straw and smoking Marlboro Reds and, you know, kind of a questionable hygiene and so on. But these guys were actually just sort of middle-class Americans, some of them extremely well-read in the history of the Civil War and even in Lincoln. And I found, to my consternation, that a lot of them knew more about Lincoln than I did. What was even worse, though, when I went down there was I found that the people who were defending Lincoln were doing it in the most sort of sentimental, kind of soupy way. You know, there was a big conference of Lincoln historians to defend the placing of the statue down there. And they would say things like Lincoln was great because he was very comfortable with ambiguity, or he was, tolerance of other people's ideas was one of his signal attributes, mm-hmm. and so on. Well, these are sort of things that I got the idea that we were projecting onto Lincoln rather than Lincoln himself, and it was a very sort of tepid defense. So that intrigued me more than anything. When I finally left Richmond, I realized I was really at the beginning of a story and not at the end.
You have a line in here in your book is just a great line to think about. You ever wonder why there are no statues of Abraham Lincoln in the entire southern half of the United States?
Right.
Did you actually follow through on that to see whether that was true?
Yes, I haven't been able to find anyone who can, except for the one in Richmond now, been able to find anyone who's seen one in the old Confederacy, and I think that's a true statement. Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the people who on each side of this issue, the people who are there to oppose the placing of a Lincoln and Tad statue, Bragdon Bowling.
Yeah, Bragg Bowling was the commander, they call him, of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the Virginia chapter. And the Sons bills itself as a heritage group. Contrary to the way a lot of us on the outside might see them, they don't really consider themselves a racial or a racialist sort of group. They want to defend the heritage of their great-grandfathers who fought in the Civil War, great-great-grandfathers. And they're quite serious about it. And as I say, they know a good deal. And Bragg, because he was the... He was, I guess, sort of the leader of the opposition to the placing the statue in Richmond, became sort of a local celebrity. He was very good with a quote. He had, as I say, a wonderful knowledge of Richmond history and Southern history, and he became very adept at using the media to get his point across.
You point out some of the particulars of his indictment of Lincoln. With his generals, he invented the concept of total war, waged campaigns of unprecedented savagery against noncombatants and private property in the Shenandoah Valley, Sherman's march through Georgia and elsewhere, the father of big government, vastly expanding the reach of Imperial Washington. So these are things that I guess we probably don't give much thought to, but apparently in the South, in Richmond, it's still very much alive.
Yeah, they're very sensitive to these things. And again, there is enough truth in their criticisms of Lincoln to make them compelling. And I think any fair-minded person, especially someone like me who didn't quite know very much about Lincoln and kind of had this gauzy view of him, should be pulled up short by some of the accusations they make about Lincoln. They also held a conference, the Lincoln haters, as I call them, held a conference in Richmond with several scholars who came. And for an entire day, we met in a musty old hotel in downtown Richmond, which is kind of a worn-out, abandoned downtown, as you can imagine, like a lot of mid-sized cities. And I sat there for an entire day while Lincoln was just raked over the coals. And again, what struck me was the sophistication of it. It wasn't just racist ranting. It wasn't just that they saw Lincoln as Hitler or something like that. Some of it was really quite... nuanced and historically informed criticism of Lincoln. And as I say, this kind of threw me for a loop. I wasn't really expecting this at all.
When you write, when he was alive, Abraham Lincoln was one of the most intensely hated public figures the country has ever known. The minute he got shot, however, things began looking up for him. And I think we forget about that most intensely hated side prior to his death.
Right. Well, this is what I noticed in some of the Lincoln defenders, is that they wanted to kind of smooth off his rough edges. Lincoln waged, as Bragg Bowling would say, although I think Bragg kind of overstates it, Lincoln waged a incredibly bloody war. And he didn't do it for nothing. He did it because he wanted the country to be a certain kind of country. He was a man of deep principal who was willing to risk everything in support of that, including the country itself. And so this isn't a guy who's just kind of touchy-feely and, you know, comfortable with ambiguity, as they say, and all that sort of stuff. This was a guy who really believed in something and was willing to go to the very last quarter to promote what he believed. Now, no wonder, given that, he still arouses such passions among people, especially the people who don't like him.
Andrew Ferguson is our guest. We'll take a call from Daniel and your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kathleen Dunn has the day off. I'm Jim Packard in for her, and we're talking about Abraham Lincoln with Andrew Ferguson, the author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. By the way, Andrew Ferguson will be talking in Milwaukee on Wednesday, June 13th at 7 p.m. at Schwartz Bookshop in Bayview, just off Lincoln Avenue, 2262 South Kinnickinnick Avenue. For more information on that visit, 414-481-3401. And again, thank you so much for being with us today, Andrew.
Well, I'm very happy to be here.
And let's go to the phones to take Daniel's call in Rice Lake. Hello, Daniel. What can we do for you?
Hello. How could Lincoln be so naive to think that the violence of the Civil War and the hatred of Lincoln, especially by the defeated Southerners, wouldn't result in threats against his life and his possible assassination?
Yes. Well, that's a very good point. I don't think Lincoln was naive about that. In fact, he was shot at a couple of years before the actual assassination as he rode on horseback to his summer home up in northwest Washington. He also, though, had a fatalistic streak to him. You know, people talk about his spiritual side, and his religion was really sort of ambiguous. No one's really quite sure what his spiritual beliefs were, but he did seem to have a strong view in sort of what will be, and I think that he included his own safety in that. He generally tried to get free of his bodyguards. The bodyguards that he did have weren't particularly competent, and he was open to the public in a way that is simply unimaginable to us today. And I think the reason for that was that he just thought, if they're going to get me, they're going to get me. And there's not much I can do about it.
Daniel?
Oh, that's an amazing character fault, isn't it?
Well, I don't know if it's a fault or not. I think it's simply his, I suppose you could say it was irresponsible in one sense. That he did have an obligation to keep himself safe. He wasn't reckless. I shouldn't say that he was reckless, but I think he did. He was quite familiar with death. His mother had died at an early age. He'd lost his sister in childbirth, and he'd lost two children by this time, who had died very young. And I think he was quite conscious of mortality, and this gave him, as I say, this fatalistic sense.
Daniel, thank you very much for the call. You mentioned a little earlier the spiritual side to Lincoln. His friends, he appeared to be a man of few and ambiguous religious beliefs, quoted the Bible often, but never joined a church.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, when he ran for president in 1860, in his native town of Springfield, every preacher and minister in the town pointedly refused to endorse him. His wife went to church, a church right near their house in Springfield. He would show up once in a while, but he never actually joined a church. He had been raised as a Baptist in a small sect of the Baptist faith, I guess you would say. But it was clear from early on that he was not a church-going sort of person. Of course, this has become a huge topic among scholars and Lincoln buffs ever since. I think as he became such a revered personage after his death, especially Christians wanted him to be one of their own. This is a typical phenomenon. Everybody wanted to claim Lincoln, but it was particularly true for people who thought, how could a man who is so great not have had a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, or however you'd put that? But the facts are pretty clear that he was not religious in any conventional sense at all.
You mentioned that a famed seer of the time, back in the 1890s, Nettie Colburn Maynard, published a long study called Was Abraham Lincoln a Spiritualist? And she made a comparison, or the publicist may have made the comparison, of Lincoln to Christ.
Oh, sure. This was, you know, Lincoln was killed on Good Friday. He was shot on Good Friday, died Saturday morning. And, of course, every pulpit in America the following day, when everyone knew of his death, thanks to the Telegraph, was home to a sermon pointing out the likeness, that here is the man who saved our country, killed on Good Friday, and he instantly became a martyr on Christian lines. And I think that that has, in a way, colored how we've seen him ever since.
Our guest is Andrew Ferguson. Telephone number in Madison for your call is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. We talked a little bit about the opposing people to putting a statue of Lincoln in Richmond, Virginia. Let's talk about the proponent of such a statue, Robert Klein.
Right. Well, this was also, as I say, part of the surprise of going down to Richmond, and wasn't just the people who who despised Lincoln, but the people who were defending him. Mr. Klein ran something called the United States Historical Society, which is not really a historical society, but is a nonprofit organization that develops historical knickknacks, I guess you'd call them, and markets them. Mr. Klein's idea was that he would sponsor this statue that would go into this park there in Richmond on the banks of the James, and then meanwhile he would make smaller casts of the statue and sell them over the internet and through magazine ads and even television ads and so on. So one thing that I discovered once again when I went down to Richmond was it wasn't a scam exactly, but there was a commercial motive behind it. And sure enough, as I talked to Mr. Klein, I realized again that if you scratch anything in America, pretty soon you're going to come up against some kind of commercial motive.
He takes the idea, the concept for the statue to Virginius Dabney.
Mm-hmm.
And who's Mr. Dabney?
Virginius Dabney was a great biographer of Robert E. Lee, and a sort of a gray eminence there in Richmond, probably the most revered personage in Richmond. He was dead by the time the statue went in, but he was a very highly sought of newspaper man and amateur historian and so on. And Dabney thought that it was a great idea to put in a statue of Lincoln in Richmond. And I think if Dabney had been alive by the time the statue actually was going in, there might not have been so much consternation about it, because he was able to speak in good faith to both sides. The neo-Confederate types really revered Dabney as a great historian of the South, and he was sort of liberal enough and moderate enough that the city fathers had respect for him as well. But as I say, there wasn't, by the time the statue was actually put in, there wasn't really much that could have prevented it going in. You had the National Park Service behind it, the mayor, the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia, the entire business establishment of Richmond. And this another interesting twist to this story is that the guys who were trying to keep the statue from going in really were sort of saw themselves as a victimized minority. Here they are, they're all sort of middle-class white guys, dressed in khakis and polo shirts and could have been airlifted off any suburban golf course in America. And they had somehow managed to absorb this sense of themselves as a tiny victimized minority with the entire establishment arrayed against them.
Let's go to the phones again to Marie in Madison. Hello, Marie. What can we do for you?
Hi. I am originally from North Carolina in the South, and I was listening to the show, and there was a comment that there weren't any statues for Abraham Lincoln or something along those lines. And I actually went to a small college in Harrogate, Tennessee, called Lincoln Memorial University.
Oh, sure.
And when I was there, they celebrated their 100 years. So, yeah, it's a small little town. But Lincoln promised to, because he was so touched by the devastation that the Civil War caused to this little town in the mountains in Cumberland Gap, that he put a college there. He said, I need to, give back to this part of the South because he felt so strongly about it. So they celebrate Lincoln in quite a different way than some places in the South do. And I think it just depends on where you are in the South, how people feel about Lincoln. But I think in the South, we approach it in a more realistic kind of manner. Lincoln, we don't really sugarcoat him as much as you would think in the North. That's my comment.
Okay.
Well, that's very good, and that's very interesting. I'd forgotten the Lincoln Memorial University actually has a wonderful library and a wonderful collection of Lincoln stuff. And it was kind of a holdout of pro-Lincoln sentiment. Of course, Tennessee itself was divided during the Civil War between pro-Confederate and pro-Union sentiments, and Lincoln struggled very hard, of course, to keep Tennessee and Kentucky both in the Union as far as he could. So, yes, I think that's a very good point, that in certain parts, especially along the border states, there's a lot of, there's still pockets of Lincoln sentiment.
Well, I'm enjoying the show, so thank you very much.
Marie, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Dara in Racine. Hello, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. And my comment is that my, I think it was great-great-great-uncle David Derrickson was one of Lincoln's bodyguards, and I hope he was one of the better ones. And I know their relationship has been written about. And actually, I have a question on that, if you know anything. But my real question that I called for was both Racine and Kenosha here in southeastern Wisconsin have statues of Lincoln. And Racine actually has a neighborhood named after him. And I know that they consider Racine College, which is now the Dekoven Center, at the school for their son. And I wonder if you could tell us more about Lincoln's relationship with southeastern Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. Well, what little I know about that region there, of course, it was early on a hotbed of Republicanism, and the Ripon Society of was founded there, and Lincoln traveled quite a bit to, especially southern Wisconsin, as they tried to build the Republican Party in the late 50s. You know, by the early 50s, the Whig Party, and Lincoln had always been a Whig, was pretty much been torn apart by the slavery question.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of former Whigs got together and founded the Republican Party, which had strong abolitionist sentiments. Lincoln himself was not an abolitionist, but slavery was a very important issue to him. And so there was a great deal of travel all around the Midwest, but particularly to southern Wisconsin, on Lincoln's part to try and seed this new Republican Party. So it was Wisconsin and the Republican Party have a very long history together, and it's absolutely crucial to the development of Lincoln's party.
Dara, thank you so much. It is not unusual for a community to have an area, maybe Lincoln Village, or it just seems like Lincoln is the most prominent president in America today in terms of locations and parks and schools and things like that.
Yes, I've seen some figures, and they're a little iffy to me, but apparently there are more commemorative things, as in streets and towns and colleges and so on, named after Lincoln, even in Washington. And of course, Washington had a jump on Lincoln of about 60 years. But it was a way, especially after Lincoln's martyrdom, as they called it, it was a way for a community to associate itself with greatness and with the very best ideals of the country, which is what Lincoln had come to represent. And so it's not much. Not surprising that people wanted to associate themselves with that. And it became kind of a classy thing. If you could, you know, name your housing development after Lincoln in some way, it kind of elevated it.
To a new status.
Right.
Mark in Green Bay, let's give you a chance. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, what was Lincoln's attitude or expressed attitude and actions in regards to Native Americans?
Ah, well, that's actually become, in the last 20, 25 years, an intense area of scholarship in Lincoln, because it had been ignored, for obvious reasons, I suppose, over the years. Lincoln did not concentrate a lot on the federal government's relationship with the Indians, simply because he was sort of preoccupied. At the same time, however, there was a lot going on out there, and I suppose some of the most important things that we remember about Lincoln and his interaction with the Native Americans show Lincoln up in a pretty good light. For example, there was a terrible massacre in Minnesota in 1863, I believe, in which well over 300 Indians were tried, so to speak, and condemned to death. Lincoln commuted the sentence of almost all of them, except for, I think, about 35 of those Indians who then were put to death, but most of them were let off. Lincoln seemed to have a sense that there was a festering problem there that was going to have to be resolved, and there was even some suggestion that he was going to turn his attention to that in his second administration. Of course, he didn't live to have a second administration, unfortunately. Now, one thing I noticed when among the Lincoln haters, one of their indictments of Lincoln is that he somehow set in motion the terrible cleansing campaigns in the West, in which resulted in almost the complete genocide of the American Indians after they were deported out west of the Mississippi. A number of his generals, Sherman and Sheridan, for example, Custer himself, were absolutely essential to that very cruel and unfortunate, to say the least, effort. I think that's a little far-fetched. I think it's hard to associate Lincoln with that terrible tragedy. But there are people who will use that as an indictment against him.
Lincoln, of course, was captain of a company that was called up to fight the Indian uprising led by Black Hawk. Mm-hmm. This is the 175th anniversary of the summer of the Black Hawk War.
That's right.
So there's a lot of attention being paid to Black Hawk, and a new book out on him, as a matter of fact.
Yes, Black Hawk was a very interesting figure, obviously, and very important to the prairie where Lincoln spent his young manhood. He was elected the captain of his company, and all the way to the end of his life said that no other achievement of his gave him as much pleasure as being elected captain of the company. Of course, they never did see any action. They went out and they mustered around and marched around and shot their guns in the air for a few months and then came back. And as Lincoln later said, he himself was the veteran of many bloody battles with the mosquitoes.
And if you'd like to join this conversation with Andrew Ferguson, all you have to do is give us a call in Madison. The number there is 263-1890 or toll-free at 800-642-1234. Andrew's the author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. It's out, it's new, it's fresh, and it's very interesting. Mary Lee in Wisconsin Dells is next. Hi, Mary Lee.
I was wondering if you have read the book Manhunt or Manhunter. I can't remember. It's about Lincoln's assassination and subsequent chase to find John Wilkes Booth and his co-conspirators. It's wonderful. And have you read it, and has it affected your book?
Oh, yes. Yes, in fact, James Swanson, the author, lives here in Washington and is a friend of mine. Yes, it's a terrific book. It's like reading a thriller. The assassination itself was filled with really wonderful, sort of seedy, grimy characters, and from you know, we're what 140 years away from it now, so we can kind of look at it more as a thriller and as a detective story than what it was at the time, which was a massive mobilization of the police powers of the United States. Thousands of people were apprehended and dragnets and called in on suspicion of being members of a vast conspiracy to kill the president. And I think that Swanson's book really does capture that beautifully. My book has less to do with although there's quite a bit of history in it, has less to do with the assassination and with recounting the actual series of events that led up to that. But it's a terrific book.
Mary Lee, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's talk about Billy Herndon. This is somebody I was not familiar with, and yet he's very close relationship with Abe Lincoln.
Absolutely, and essential in the whole Lincoln story, really. After I left Richmond, I decided that, you know, I really needed to figure out what I knew about Lincoln, and I wanted to learn more. And more to the point, I wanted to learn how is it that we know what we think we know about Lincoln? How did we find out about him, and so on? Anybody who sort of pursues that question runs right up against a wild and woolly character named William Herndon. Herndon was Lincoln's law partner for the last 20 years of Lincoln's life, and a much younger man, and in temperament totally opposite to Lincoln. He worshipped Lincoln, but he himself was, where Lincoln was sort of cool and detached, Herndon was wild and intemperate and extravagant in his speech and his language. He was a big boozer, of course, and Lincoln did not drink at all. And they were a fascinating sort of Jack Sprat kind of team, the two of them, and people remarked on how different they were. But Herndon worshipped Lincoln and thought Lincoln was the greatest man he had, not just that he had ever known, but probably the greatest man who had ever lived. When Lincoln died, within a week, Herndon had resolved to write the definitive biography of his law partner and his fallen friend. And so he went out and he did one of the great, I guess you'd say, pieces of journalism or historical research that has ever been undertaken in the United States. He got on his horseback and he rode around to the small towns through the Midwest into southern Indiana, all the way back into Kentucky, to interview everyone who had known Lincoln as a young man or as a boy. The notes that he took are now in the Library of Congress. They run to several thousand pages of handwritten material of very close transcriptions of the interviews that he got. Anybody who wants to know anything about Lincoln sooner or later runs up against that material, because it's sort of the fountain from which all of our Lincoln knowledge comes. And I think he's a very great man. He's misunderstood. As I said, he was an alcoholic, and he was basically kind of lazy and ineffectual in his life. But he left us this tremendous legacy that even now historians are trying to grapple with and argue over.
Our guest is Andrew Ferguson, senior editor at the Weekly Standard and the author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. We'll continue in just a moment. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you with us this morning on Memorial Day. As we look at Lincoln's place in America today with Andrew Ferguson, the author of Land of Lincoln, let's go back to the phones, take some more calls. Scott in DeForest is next. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for taking my call, and good morning to you both. What prompted my looking into a couple things about Lincoln was seeing some writing on some of the Confederate money that said something along the lines of good for redemption in bullion or whatever within 6 months after reunification. And that prompted me to do a little research, and I found at least a couple of historians who make the argument that the Civil War was not inevitable, that really what the South was concerned about was not slavery, that they actually themselves thought it was a doomed institution, but it was getting compensated for the slaves that they owned. And what they worried about was that too many states would be coming in as free states, and they would be outvoted in getting that compensation. And what they really intended to do, it was more a bluff than anything. They wanted to bloody the North's nose a bit and then reunify and get what they wanted. And that had Lincoln and the Republicans actually said to him, okay, tell you what, leave, but you'll have to reapply for admission as a free state. Oh, and by the way, any slaves that make it to our borders, we're going to let in as freedmen, so that the South would constantly be in the position of having to guard their northern border. This argument runs that what would finally wind up happening is that the South was so poorly led and so poorly organized and so poorly economically outfitted that they probably would have fallen apart, and within a generation would have come back all applying as free states, and there would not have necessarily been a civil war. Are you familiar with this at all, and what do you think of that?
Oh, sure, absolutely. This is you said it much better than I could. This is a very strongly held point of view among, I would say a large minority of historians, but a very respectable number and a very good historians believe this. In fact, the some of the first great biographies of Lincoln in the 20th century were written by biographers who essentially took that point of view, that the war was itself unnecessary, and that Lincoln, by forcing the issue, caused the war to gain in its ferocity, and it lasted much longer than it would have otherwise. My own view is that that is a little too convenient, and it's sort of a retrospective view that we can kind of see things now that we wouldn't have seen at the time. If you were actually in Lincoln's situation, knowing what he knew, having gone through the 1850s with the terrible bad feeling that had been aroused through then, and in fact the quite militant advocacy of slavery that was taking place in the South in the 1850s, I think he would have seen the slave power as a much more destructive and a potent force than the historians that you're describing see it as now. So, but again, it's one of these endlessly fascinating discussions that you can have, and I'm not sure that it will ever be resolved.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Scott, thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And on to Bob in Marquette, Iowa. Hi, Bob.
Well, good morning, Jim, and thank you for a superb program. I'm really enjoying this. And I just have a question for Mr. Ferguson with regards to President Lincoln's view of American Indians, and I know you touched on it earlier, but I wonder if Lincoln had this fatalistic streak in him, if you will, how that would have played out, because Lincoln is responsible for signing the Homestead Act, which, mm-hmm. I mean, one could see the writing on the wall, what impact that would have on the American Indians. And how did that play, do you think, in Lincoln's psyche? And did he take that into consideration as far as what that meant to the native peoples, primarily west of the Missouri River?
That's an excellent question, and I've thought about it some, and I can't really resolve that to my own satisfaction. The Homestead Act is now looked on, I think, by a large number of people as a sort of a completely win-win situation, that it was, you know, there was really no downside to it. But of course, that's not true at all. As you say, it's set in motion, I think probably made inevitable, the destruction of the Native Americans in the areas that had been opened up to settlement, and made inevitable the terrible clashes that happened. Now, whether Lincoln had that in his mind or not, I'm a little skeptical, because I don't think that Lincoln was... as I say, I don't think that the issues of Native Americans were front and center in his mind. What he did firmly believe in was a kind of version of manifest destiny, if you remember that term, that there was something, not divine, but something ordained about the country and the spread of its institutions across the whole continent. And so I don't think that he would have seriously considered the impact on American Indians of what he was doing in trying to advance the expansion of the country.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great show, and I appreciate it.
Bob, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's give Janetta a chance here in Dodgeville. Janetta, you still there? Sorry. We missed her, and I'm sorry. If she can call back, we'll get her back on. Let's talk about the Association of Lincoln Presenters. Very interesting group.
Yeah, I'd say of all the things that I ran into in my travels, the ALP, as it's called, Abraham Lincoln Presenters, is probably the most eccentric and most wonderful in a lot of ways. It's a group of about 250 to 300 men, mostly, who make a living dressing up as Abraham Lincoln. And as most trades do, they have a society, and they get together once a year and have a convention where they trade stories and new tips on how to go about their business and so on. The year that I went, which is a couple of years ago, They happened to be holding their annual convention in Santa Claus, Indiana, in Santa's Lodge, which is the only hotel in Santa Claus, Indiana. So I was sort of came up against this collision of icons, if you will, where on the one hand I walked into the lobby of Santa's Lodge and I heard all the little Christmas carols going, and you know, you see these little animatronic elves and Christmas trees everywhere, and then amidst them all were 150 guys dressed exactly like Abraham Lincoln looking at me, and I thought, you know, boy, I'm not in Kansas anymore. But it turned out to be a wonderful experience. It was a weekend in spring, and it was beautiful weather, and these guys were absolutely as sweet and full of Lincoln lore as you could imagine. One thing I did notice about a lot of them is, though they are professional Abraham Lincoln presenters, as they call themselves, not impersonators, but they're presenters, a very large number of them bear no resemblance to Abraham Lincoln whatsoever. They all have the beard, but a number of them were about as wide as they were tall. The president of the association at the time was a wonderful man named Dr. Bassick, who was a retired psychologist, was himself about 5'6" and bald. But for them, it didn't really seem to matter, because I think they thought Lincoln was sort of a spiritual thing. They were trying to capture the spiritual essence of this great man, and that's what they had dedicated their life to.
You have a description of Lincoln in which he writes himself, he's in height over 6'4", nearly, lean in flesh, but very understated, a good 7 inches over average height, always ill-dressed, hair uncombed, loose-jointed and high-waisted, narrow at the upper chest with gumby arms and enormous hands and feet. Lincoln was, by all accounts, one of the most extraordinary-looking men any of his contemporaries had ever seen. That might have accounted, I suppose, for his being an unusual political candidate, in that once you saw him, you would remember him.
Yes, that was certainly part of his appeal and power. When I was going through this, every once in a while I just wish you could have a film of Lincoln, because we see him, you know, perched on that big chair in the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, or in, you know, these very beautiful statues that are all over the country. But apparently he was an extremely animated man, and when he would give a speech, he didn't just stand there and, you know, with his hand on his lapel, he would prowl the stage, he would crouch down, he would leap up, his voice would go up and down in register. He had a deep prairie twang. His face was extremely lively and animated. His eyes would pop out. He had a big laugh, the big booming cackle. This terrible statue vision that we have of him really isn't accurate at all. And a lot of, of course, we don't know, except for a few written descriptions of exactly how he moved and how he captivated a crowd. But there's no question that he was one of the great speakers of his day, and people really tried to study him and learn from him.
You set off on this journey and started in Richmond and have gone on to write this book. What's the most interesting thing that you did not know about Lincoln that you found out along the way?
Well, I think this is part of it, this sort of human side to him, that in fact, although I say at the end of the book, Lincoln the icon, this great figure in the Lincoln Memorial, is essential to our understanding of Lincoln and is very important. There still was this human side that tends to get lost. The sense of him as a very animated, lively man. Obviously, we know about his humor, but he was also apparently quite a passionate man. He was moody, but he also had a temper. There were all kinds of things. And the deeper you go into him, the more you see glimpses of this animated, real human being, but he's always just beyond your reach. He always just seems to slip away when you try and get a handle on him. And that sort of, I guess, again, we go back to the word ambiguity about him, is what makes him so tantalizing, and I think it's why we'll never get enough of him.
And in order to understand Lincoln, do you have to see the big statue at the National Mall?
In my opinion, yes, because as I say, even though the human Lincoln is tantalizing and endlessly fascinating, what we need as a country, and this is a good day to say this on Memorial Day. We need this icon because we say that Lincoln preserved the Union, which is true, but that doesn't go far enough. Lincoln wanted to preserve a certain kind of union. It was a union dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. And if we forget that in our pursuit of the individual Lincoln, or Lincoln is a gay icon, or Lincoln is a manic depressive, or Lincoln is a liberal or a conservative, if we forget that essential truth about him, that this is the country that he wanted to preserve, then we are much, much poorer as a country and a people.
You are coming to Milwaukee in mid-June to talk. You're going to be talking at Schwartz Bookshop in Bayview. It's just off Lincoln Avenue. It would have been perfect if it were on Lincoln Avenue. But it is on Kinnikinick Avenue, 2262 South Kinnikinick. And I'm sure that now that you're out with the book, you're going to have lots of people there.
I hope so. I haven't been in Milwaukee in about 10 years, and it's a great place. I can hardly wait to be there.
Andrew Ferguson, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much, and happy Memorial Day.
Andrew Ferguson is a senior editor at the Weekly Standard. He's written for publications like The New Yorker, The New Republic, The Washington Post, and many other national publications. The author of Land of Lincoln, Adventures in Abe's America. It's published by Grove Atlantic. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn. She'll be in tomorrow here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.